This is Nightly Business Report with Tyler Matheson and Sue Herrera.
Apple of Wall Street's eye. A strong quarter sends shares of the tech company to a new record after hours. What's next?
Split decision. There's a widening divide between investors who think stocks are vulnerable and others who absolutely don't. So what should you do when Wall Street can't agree?
And a growing threat. As the tension mounts between the U.S. and North Korea, potential economic hazards are starting to become more clear. All that and more for Tuesday, August 1st.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. So, how do you like them apples? Now, Apple CEO Tim Cook is a modest sort, but tonight, no one would criticize him for crowing. That's because the king of Cupertino, Apple, shut down the worry warts and beat profit and revenue estimates. And oh yeah, the company sold more iPhones than expected too. Here are the big numbers. Apple earned $1.67 a share. That's a full dime ahead of Wall Street forecasts. Sales rose 7% to a shade below $45.5 billion, or about a half billion a day. The company even grew its enormous cash reserves 13% to $261 billion. Shares took off after the numbers came out, pushing them to an all-time high. Josh Lipton has the biggest takeaway from Apple's big quarter.
41 million. That was one big number in Apple's latest earnings report. Refers to the number of iPhones that Apple shipped in the quarter, and it was better than expected. Analysts thought Apple would ship 40.7 million iPhone units in the quarter. I did have the chance to speak briefly with Apple CEO Tim Cook. He says the demand was actually better than those shipments indicate because he took down iPhone inventory by more than 3 million units in the quarter. He also says there is some pause going on here. In other words, consumers aren't buying iPhones right now because they're waiting for that new iPhone to come out, which we all expect in the fall. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Josh Lipton, Cupertino, California.
So let's turn now to Timothy Lesko for more on Apple's earnings and what he sees ahead for the company. He is principal portfolio manager at Granite Investment Advisors. Nice to see you again. Welcome back, Tim.
Oh, thanks for having me, Sue.
Let's start, first of all, with Apple itself from a stock performance. It did hit a new all-time high. You're still bullish on the stock, though.
Right. When we look at a stock, we look at what we think its fair value is, and we feel it's been trading at a discount to that fair value really for a long time. So, you know, trailing earnings like we saw today are a nice validation of the opinion that we've had, but it doesn't mean that there's not more earnings to come and perhaps more stock appreciation.
It's up 41% in the past year. It sits roughly at $150 a share. Where do you see it a year from now? What's the upside here?
Well, the upside, even if Apple doesn't earn a whole lot more in earnings per year than they're earning right now, it still trades at a discount to the market as a whole. You know, part of your lead-in was the discussion about the difference between investors who think the market is overvalued and investors who think that the market is just fine. Apple's really stayed within that just fine valuation for some time. So if you just put a market valuation on Apple, you could see another 10 or 15% in the stock.
So as you look at this earnings report, what impressed you the most, and where does Apple, if anywhere at all, need to improve?
Well, I think what impressed us the most were the reacceleration of Mac sales and iPad sales. You know, after a really nearly a five-year decline in the category, and they introduced some new products in the spring that really seemed to be gaining some traction. And if you look forward, what we really see Apple as, rather than just an iPhone sales vehicle, is a company that allows you to manage your digital life, whether it be your social media, your photos, your internet access, your email, really whatever it is. And there are a lot of different devices you have to choose from to use. And really, Apple wants to be, call it front of mind for the high-end consumer.
Is there any, you know, a lot of manufacturing, let me come at this a different way. There was a time when Dell was king of the world. There have been times when IBM was the king of the world, and other manufacturers of computers or phones, Nokia comes to mind, that they were very, very good. Could Apple conceivably get displaced?
I think that's a great point, Tyler. If you look at IBM and Dell, they were really selling based on low-margin computers where somebody else was making the operating system. Nokia is probably a better example, where Nokia, with the operating system they had for cell phones, really owned the cell phone market before the iPhone came along. And they saw, you know, nearly 80-90% kind of market share go to, you know, next to nothing now.
Or BlackBerry.
And that probably is the big
BlackBerry
risk.
BlackBerry, too.
Or BlackBerry for that matter. And I think the real key is in the software, yet everybody pays so much attention to the hardware. And if you just turn to hardware for a second, Apple, since its infancy, has always maintained a higher margin on its computers because they believe in vertical integration, while everybody else was just making, call it beige boxes, supporting other people's software.
Their innovation is evolutionary. It doesn't always have to be revolutionary.
Absolutely, and I think you've seen that in the iPhone since its inception. There were other touchscreen phones. There were other music players before the iPod. Mm-hmm. Apple just took a device and a need and made it much more consumer-friendly. So if you look at the magic of Apple, it's really their ability to read how people work and how people want to work and deliver them a software package that does it.
Well, they're delivering for investors tonight. Thank you, Tim. Nice to see you again. Timothy
Lesko.
Yeah,
thank you for having me.
With Granite Investment Advisors.
Well, stocks closed the first day of August, which is usually not such a great month, but they did it today, closing at another all-time high, the Dow's 31st record close of the year. But it didn't have quite enough steam to break that 22,000 mark. The Dow closed up 72 at 21,963. Check back tomorrow, because that Apple number may shoot it above 22 grand. The NASDAQ added 14. The S&P 500 tacked on 6.
And the president took two. Where else? Twitter this morning to tout the fact that the Dow is in rarefied air. He tweeted, stock market could hit all-time high again. 22,000 today was 18,000 only 6 months ago on Election Day. Mainstream media seldom mentions.
But while we sit at record levels on the Dow, there are growing divergences on Wall Street from strategist opinions to where the money is actually going. The splits on the street are starting now to become very pronounced, very obvious. Bob Pisani takes a look.
The markets continue to climb to new heights, but there's a series of divergences occurring that could give investors pause for the month of August. First, a notable divergence between the Dow Industrials, which were up 3% in July, and the transports. They were down 4% in July. This is after the transport hit new highs. So these stocks are lower across the board, whether we're talking about planes, trains, or automobiles. What's going on? Well, you can only stretch a rubber band so far. For the transports, there's some disappointment about the Trump agenda, mixed in with better opportunities overseas. There's also lower business from key sectors like retails, autos, and oil that the transports depend on. Throw in some issues around pricing, and you've got reasons for a divergence. Now, under Dow theory, remember, when the transports significantly stray from the industrials after hitting new highs, it's considered a negative for the markets. But there's bigger issues. The major indices are at new highs, and strategists are split over the direction of the markets for August. The bulls are touting strong corporate earnings, that's true, low interest rates, and a synchronized global recovery as reasons for the rally to roll on. But the bears are concerned about rising stock prices, record low volatility, and central banks that could rein in stimulus. There's even a growing divide over exactly where the money is going. So, for example, exchange-traded funds, or ETFs, have now dropped $3 trillion in assets after seeing huge inflows last month. In fact, ETFs held $1 trillion more than hedge funds for the first time ever. That means lower cost ETFs are winning out over pricier rivals. Passive indexing, better than ever. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Bob Pisani at the New York Stock Exchange.
So what should you do when Wall Street is divided over the future of the stock market? Tim Maurer is Director of Personal Finance at BAM Alliance, and he joins us now to talk more about that. Nice to have you with us, Tim. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
There's always kind of a divide. I mean, that's kind of what makes a market. You have some people who are bullish, some people who are bearish. However, when you get a divide like we're starting to see on Wall Street, what should the individual investor do?
Well, the individual investor should do virtually nothing. You're right. This is a natural part of the market process. There's always going to be a buyer. There's always going to be a seller. It's not even just a zero-sum game. It's a negative-sum game because somebody's going to be losing. Someone may be winning some, but then there's also the cost of the investment. And that's one of the reasons we also shouldn't be surprised about seeing opposing forces at the same firm. Wall Street has often been on both sides of the transaction because they're selling investment products that benefit from being on both sides of those transactions. What we need to remember, what you need to remember as an individual investor is your financial plan, your investment plan, not necessarily the plan of these bigger corporations.
You know, I have very good news, Tim. Since the last time we spoke, I have learned how to tie my own bow tie. How do you like that?
Oh,
you promised me you were going to give me
Tyler.
Lessons,
so
but I didn't even need
hear
it.
That.
I was speaking last night with a financial advisor who went to the point you just made, and that is he says that what you need to pay attention to is what your baseline allocations are. Domestic stocks, international stocks. Let's say you have 20% targeted for international stocks. When that number goes down to 17%, you would then add more. If it goes up to 23%, you would trim back. Is that a good smart, whether it's the 3 percentage points or something else, is that what you really need to keep in mind?
Absolutely. And that's why I tell people, so it's not just in action. It's not that you set it and forget it forever, Tyler. When we see these market moves, when we hear these loud voices on Wall Street, honestly, it's often a good sign that we probably should be going back and taking a look at our portfolio. We shouldn't necessarily do what they say, but I absolutely invite investors to take a look at rebalancing. If you have a plan in place, if you know that it's a good, solid allocation, then that is the work of the investor, to go back at times where the market goes up a lot or goes down a lot and make that reallocation, taking from the winners, if you will, and giving to the losers so that you can benefit from the next upswing in a different allocation.
Does it make a difference with the market at all-time highs and near that round number for the Dow anyway of the 22,000 mark? Should that matter to an individual investor?
Well, here's the funny thing. If you own an asset that continually goes up, that you expect should make money over time, we should reasonably expect it to reach its all-time high quite often. Hopefully so, right? I mean, don't get me wrong. I absolutely do expect that we could see a correction. We may even be overdue, as it were. But one of the things that I've learned in my 20 years in this business and working with individuals in investing is this. We don't know when it's going to happen.
Right.
Active investors have proven over 95% wrong over time. So sure, you can give it your best shot to try and be in that 5%, or you can stay on the side of probability, stay invested with a good allocation.
Sounds like good advice. Thank you, Tim. Tim Maurer with BAM Alliance.
Well, auto sales shifted into a lower gear in July as the industry wrestles with a slowdown in demand, and it's a pronounced one. Overall, sales fell for the fifth straight month, down 7% to an annualized pace of 16.7 million vehicles. That's down more than a million from a year ago. Phil LeBeau has more on the summer slowdown in the showroom.
Summer is traditionally the busiest time of the year for auto dealers, but in July, sales cooled off, with General Motors reporting a 15% drop in sales as the big three all reported weaker than expected business. Toyota bucked the trend with positive sales, fueled in part by solid demand for its crossovers and SUVs. But in general, dealers are taking longer than ever to sell new vehicles. In fact, Edmunds.com says it took an average of more than 2.5 months to sell a car or a truck once it got to the dealership, the slowest turnover rate since 2009. What's hurting business? In reality, Americans have bought so many new vehicles over the past 7 years, there's just not as much demand. Meanwhile, there's a glut of cars coming off lease that are driving down used car prices, especially on 3- and 4-year-old models that have relatively low mileage and are still in pretty good shape. As a result, automakers are wrestling with how much they can cut production, and in some cases, whether to phase out some slower-selling models. For example, Cadillac is rebalancing its lineup of cars to better meet demand. That will ultimately mean it offers one fewer model.
There is one thing that's helping automakers ride out this slowdown in sales. It's the fact that trucks, SUVs, and crossovers are still relatively strong, and those are the most profitable vehicles in the dealership. Phil LeBeau, Nightly Business Report, Chicago.
Coming up, why limited options in dealing with the North Korea crisis could come with a big economic cost.
Some data points out today on big parts of the economy. Consumer spending slowed a bit in June as personal income was stagnant. June income was unchanged, marking the first time in 7 months there wasn't a rise. This is a key number, of course, since consumer spending makes up more than two-thirds of U.S. economic activity. Separately, activity at the nation's factories in July continued to expand, but was slightly below expectations. Manufacturing counts for about 12% of the economy. One area of concern, construction spending fell, while economists had expected growth.
One of the pillars of the president's agenda is growing the economy. And yesterday's GDP number showed a bounce back from a sluggish first quarter. As Steve Leisman tells us, when it comes to a growth effect, there are ways the president could help and ways he could hurt.
Just two quarters into his presidency, how much credit can President Trump really take for the economy? Economists say not very much, so there could be some ways on the margin that he's helped and others where he may have hurt. Most economists view the better second quarter growth numbers as a bounce back from the weak first quarter and say these are early days for a president to influence the economy.
In terms of the impact of the presidency, you know, our growth rate had been around, actually before the election, was around for 2018, around a little over 2%, at about 2.3. Now it's 2.1. So I don't want to blame the president for that, but I could say that nothing's changed much.
Bruce Kasman from J.P. Morgan says the U.S. has actually been an underperformer globally, maintaining its 2% average while the rest of the world has accelerated. Here are some of the potential positive and negative effects economists are citing. The positives include deregulation, stock market gains leading to wealth effect, and maybe some additional consumer spending, a rise in business and consumer confidence, along with some potential increase in business investments. But the negatives are policy uncertainty, the ACA repeal failure, which has pushed back expectations for tax cuts. Immigration and trade are two policies from the Trump administration not well liked by economists. The end of rising regulatory costs under President Obama could be having a bigger impact than any actual deregulation by the president. Business spending did go up in the second quarter, but it seems more tied to mining and the rebound in oil prices. Taking out mining in the second quarter, business spending growth actually declined, according to work by macroeconomic advisors. Economists from both parties agree. The effects of confidence and higher stock prices, they can be gone in an instant. If the president is going to have a real impact on economic growth, it will come from legislation passed by Congress. That so far has proven elusive for the president. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Steve Leisman.
One thing that the Wall Street experts are pointing to as a possible external issue for growth and for stocks is North Korea. Today, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said stability is key.
We do not seek a regime change. We do not seek the collapse of the regime. We do not seek an accelerated reunification of the peninsula. We do not seek an excuse to send our military north of the 38th parallel. And we're trying to convey to the North Koreans, we are not your enemy. We're not your threat. But you are presenting an unacceptable threat to us. And we have to respond.
John Harwood joins us more with more. John, what was the secretary's message overall there?
The overarching message, Tyler, was we want to talk. We want to negotiate. This has been a rolling crisis across multiple administrations that's gotten worse over the last few months. And we've seen some displays of saber rattling, moving military assets, military exercises, that sort of thing. But this is Rex Tillerson at a moment where concern is rising, stepping in and saying, let's talk about what we can do to defuse the situation. That's a different tone.
It was a very blunt statement. Does it change, though, the administration's policy?
Well, not fundamentally yet, although there was a nuanced difference that Secretary Tillerson offered. He said, we don't blame China for this situation. Mm-hmm. Remember, President Trump said in the beginning of his presidency, it will be easy for China to solve this problem. Then he met with President Xi and subsequently said, well, they tried, but they couldn't get it done. Just over the weekend, in his frustration, he said that China had not done anything but talk. Now, this is Rex Tillerson trying to remove the idea of blaming China from the equation because he's hoping to engage China in those discussions, negotiations that he would like to have.
What's the view in Washington, or your view for that? Are we at the crisis point, and when could this issue begin to affect either investor psychology or maybe more dramatically the U.S. economy?
Well, this has been going on so long, Tyler, it's hard to say when it crosses the line and becomes a crisis that is unavoidable. However, we are getting closer to that point without question. One significant possibility is that if we do, in fact, use military force, That would be unpredictable, uncertain in the scope and intensity and duration. It would subject both American troops and the South Korean population to attack from the north. That could have a huge rattling effect on confidence in the U.S. economy. The second thing is, if we decide to sanction China with targeted tariffs on them as a way of pressing them to help on North Korea, they could hit back, in particular, at the agricultural sector and the aircraft industry.
All right, John Harwood, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Lumber Liquidators moves back into the black, and that's where we begin tonight's Market Focus. After facing more than 2 years of financial struggles stemming from a product scandal, the flooring retailer said it returned to profitability. Sales also cleared street targets thanks in part to a wider product assortment and improved marketing. The results were well received. The shares took off. They rose nearly 36% to $33.59. Under Armour slashed its full-year sales outlook after reporting quarterly revenue that narrowly beat street estimates. The athletic shoe and apparel maker also reported a smaller-than-expected loss and said it would cut 2% of its workforce as it works to restructure its business. Shares fell more than 8% to $18.30. Lower equipment sales caused revenue to fall and miss expectations at Xerox. The document management company did, however, beat profit estimates, and that sent shares higher by almost 6% to $32.46. And the grain processor Archer Daniels Midland said weakness in its oil seeds processing division led that company's lower than expected sales. Profit came in ahead of estimates, and the company noted that it's aggressively managing costs and capital. Shares finished up more than 2.5% to $43.30.
The U.S. government reportedly close to finalizing a deal now with Boeing to buy two of its aircraft for the administration's next Air Force One jet fleet. Earlier this year, President Trump criticized the high cost of building a new Air Force One, and according to a report by the news site Defense One, the Air Force will receive a pair of idle jetliners at a discount. Boeing shares were off 1% to $239.44. Blood testing startup Theranos has reached a settlement with its former partner Walgreens. Under the confidential agreement, Theranos said Walgreens will dismiss the suit against Theranos with no finding or implication of liability. Last year, Walgreens sued Theranos, alleging that the startup breached its contract. Walgreens shares were fractionally higher, ending the day at $81.13. Meantime, Snap, the parent company of the messaging app Snapchat, will no longer be eligible to join the S&P 500 due to a new rule. The index proprietor said it won't allow companies that issue multiple classes of shares to list because of voting inequalities between shareholder classes. Under Snap's current stock structure, it doesn't offer any voting rights. The new decision does not impact existing S&P components that do currently have those several share classes. Snap shares down 4% to $13.10. And Sprint reported its first profit in 3 years. The phone carrier cited cost cuts and an increase in subscribers. Revenue also beat street expectations. And as for Sprint merging with another entity, the company said it has had discussions with many parties, and an announcement should come in the near future. Shares popped 11% to $8.87.
Coming up, America is awash in egg, and that's no yolk. Right, Jane Wells?
Yeah, which came first, the chicken or the anchor? Record low egg prices have producers scrambling for profits. Up next, we have the dirt.
Bird flu drove up egg prices a few years ago, but now there's an oversupply, and that has sent prices lower. In fact, this year's summer prices, the lowest since 2006. There is one exception. Cage-free eggs, they're much more expensive. But as Jane Wells tells us, even that's not helping egg producers.
Producers and consumers are playing a game of chicken over prices, and consumers are winning.
Last year was a bad year for us. We lost a lot of money.
America is awash in eggs. There's a glut 2 years after prices skyrocketed when avian flu killed tens of millions of birds.
We had a lot of farmers put chickens back in. In fact, too many. and now we've got an oversupply.
It's really bad for producers like Chris Nichols, who runs a cage-free operation in California called Chino Valley Ranchers. These eggs cost $1 to $2 more per dozen than conventional eggs, and people aren't buying them.
We've had to reduce our over-inventory. We should get a certain price, and we're having to discount it below my production costs just to get it out the door.
He has about 750,000 chickens, but this year he'll reduce that number 30% until demand bounces back. And despite promises by retailers and restaurants to convert to cage-free, Nichols says some of them are starting to change their minds, and that's no yoke.
If that happens, I believe that all the rest of the players will follow suit, unless they truly believe that cage-free is the future.
Adding to the problems in the supply and demand equation, after the avian flu outbreak, many food manufacturers changed their recipes to use fewer eggs. And at the same time, because of improved genetics, hens are more productive than ever. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Jane Wells in Nuevo, California.
I love her.
Brave woman.
Brave woman. That's it for us tonight. I'm Sue Herrera. Thanks for joining us.
I'm Tyler Matheson. Thanks for me as well. Have a great evening, everybody, and we'll see you back here tomorrow night.